Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, and today we're going to, well, answer emails. And I get a lot of emails from listeners, and there's no way I can answer each one. So I think what I'll do is try to group them together today and try to answer them. For example, black holes. We've been talking about black holes recently, but, well, if black holes are invisible, then how can you possibly photograph something that's invisible? And what exists on the other side of a black hole? And for that matter, why didn't the late Stephen Hawking win the Nobel Prize for black hole research? And then I often get asked the question, where did life come from anyway? Did it come from the oceans? Did it come from the seas? Did it come from outer space? Well, the whole concept of panspermia has been getting a lot of new attention recently because of the fact that we've been tracking meteors and comets from outside the solar system. Things that were once considered to be impossible, well, we now consider to be ordinary. And for that matter, let's talk about the space program. Many people believe that we're entering the second golden era of space exploration, but what about the cost? I mean, what happened to the first great era of space exploration? It simply cost too much. What has changed? And the threat from outer space, how serious is it anyway? And then we'll say a few things about DNA. Recently, there have been a lot of stories about DNA in terms of, well, sequencing ancient animal DNA, animals that were frozen thousands of years ago. And for that matter, is it possible that one day we may be able to bring back the mammoth, bring back ancient animals that died tens of thousands of years ago? And for that matter, what about the dinosaurs? Well, let's just jump right into today's program where I'm going to answer a lot of the emails that I get. I got a lot of emails recently about black holes. One listener says, wait a minute, something's not right. I mean, after all, black holes are black. That's where the name comes from, right? They're so massive that even light itself cannot escape. But, Smarty Pants, if black holes are invisible, then how can you possibly photograph something that's invisible? Well, that's a very good question, and you're absolutely right. Black holes are invisible. They are objects so massive that even light itself cannot escape. In fact, that's why they're called black holes. So the photographs that we got from M87, which is 55 million light years from the planet Earth, is the shadow, the silhouette of an object which weighs 6.5 billion times the mass of our sun. It is a huge monster, and it's not even in our own galaxy. It's not in the Milky Way at all. It's outside the galaxy, at the heart of the galaxy M87. And so the photograph that people have been seeing is the shadow, the silhouette of the black hole. And when you see the glowing red ring around it, that's basically hot gas that's swirling around the black hole. The black hole is so massive that it eats entire star systems for breakfast and won't even burp. And speaking about eating up star systems, another question I get is, if black holes eat up everything in sight, then how come they don't gobble up the Earth? What prevents the Earth from being eaten up by a black hole? Well, first of all, there is a black hole in our own backyard. Tonight, go outside. Look in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. That is the galactic center of the Milky Way galaxy. By rights, there should be a fireball that outshines the moon that comes out every night, and it represents the center of our own galaxy. And at the center of the galactic nuclei, there is a raging monster, a black hole in our own galaxy. Now, very soon, astronomers are going to announce that, yes, they too have photographed that black hole as well. The black hole at the center of our own galaxy weighs about 4 million times the mass of the Sun, and it's small compared to the black hole at the center of M87. So why aren't we eaten up by the black hole? Well, the answer is very simple. We orbit around the black hole. It turns out that if you are outside what is called the event horizon, the point of no return, the event horizon is a sphere surrounding the black hole, and if you were to fall through the sphere, then of course you would never come out again. However, we orbit outside the sphere at a very safe distance. In fact, according to Einstein's equation, outside the event horizon of a black hole, the gravitational field is very similar to what you would expect using ordinary Newton's theory of gravity. And so that's why we don't fall into a black hole, and that's because we safely orbit around the black hole. And then another question I get is, well, Stephen Hawking was a pioneer in black hole research. Why didn't he win the Nobel Prize for it? It seems that Nobel Prizes are given for physicists who do a fraction of the work of Stephen Hawking. Well, it's because of the nature of the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize is given to people who make concrete discoveries that are tested and proven. Stephen Hawking's main contribution was to show that black holes are not really black. They're gray. Because of the quantum theory, there's uncertainty, and blackness is a state of total certainty. The absence of radiation is blackness. But that violates the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which means you can never be certain about anything physical. And that means, therefore, that black holes radiate a gentle radiation called Hawking radiation, and that was his main scientific contribution. Every physicist I know believes that, yes, black holes radiate Hawking radiation. But the problem is, it is so faint. It is so faint that we have never seen it and probably won't see it for many decades to centuries to come. As a consequence, you cannot give a Nobel Prize for a theory that has not been totally verified, even though that theory is believed to be true by many people. And then another question I get is, well, when you visit a planetarium and you listen to children talking about black holes, they ask the question, well, if everything falls in, where does it go? What's on the other side of a black hole? That's a good question. And the short answer is, we don't know. But there are theories that explain what might be on the other side of a black hole. In 1915, Einstein proposed the theory of gravity called general relativity, where he said that gravity is really an illusion caused by the bending and curvature of space and time itself. So, about a year later, a professor, Karl Schwarzschild, found a solution of Einstein's equation in 1916, which gave us the black hole that we talk about today. However, in 1963, yet another exact solution of Einstein's equations was discovered by mathematician Roy Kerr. And his theory showed that Einstein's theory for a rotating black hole, the black hole collapses not to a dot, as in the 1916 black hole, but the 1963 black hole is rotating and collapses to a ring of neutrons. And if you fall through the ring, you do not necessarily die at all. In other words, the singularity may not necessarily kill you. In fact, you can work out the mathematics and show that, yes, under many circumstances, you can go right through the ring and not be killed. So what happens? Well, Roy Kerr found that if you go through the ring, you wind up in a parallel universe. That's right, a parallel universe. And if you go back into the ring and enter it a second time, you enter a second parallel universe different from the previous two. And if you go through the ring over and over again, it's like going in an elevator in an apartment building. If you're in an apartment building and hit the first floor, you can look around. Then if you hit the second floor, well, the second floor looks very much like the first floor. You go to the third floor, and the third floor looks very much like the first floor and the second floor, except, of course, there are slight variations. Well, Roy Kerr found that, yes, a black hole does not necessarily have to end at the singularity. It can be a gateway to many parallel universes. So what's the catch? Well, first of all, this is very similar to Alice's looking glass. We all know that when Alice stuck her hand through the looking glass, her hand wound up on the other side of the universe in Wonderland. Well, the looking glass is like the solution found by Roy Kerr. But what's the catch? Well, the catch is, first of all, a lot of radiation falls into the black hole, and that may disturb Einstein's solution, which assumed that everything was concentrated in a simple ring. Second of all, we have to calculate quantum corrections. It turns out that Einstein's theory is simply not complete by itself. Einstein's equations really break down at the center of a black hole and the instant of the Big Bang. So for these very extreme areas, the location of the black hole and the origin of the universe, for these very, very strange environments, Einstein's equations break down, and we have to go to a quantum theory of gravity. At the present time, there is no quantum theory of gravity that is universally recognized and has been tested. The leading candidate, which is just a theory, untested, the leading candidate is string theory, which is what I do for a living. That's my day job, working on string theory. And string theory says that, well, yes, it's possible that there could be multiple universes out there, but you have to calculate radiation. Radiation effects may destabilize the black hole or perhaps keep the gateway open. We don't know for sure because we don't have a theory of everything that is universally accepted by all physicists. So the short answer is yes, there is a theory that there could be a white hole on the other side of a black hole. As matter flows into the black hole, it is blown out the other end as a white hole. The catch is, it is not universally accepted by all physicists, and it has not been experimentally tested. I should point, however, that the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland, is eventually going to be replaced by the next generation, which may, in fact, be able to prove the correctness or incorrectness of string theory. The Japanese, the Chinese, and the Europeans, three groups, have proposed a successor to the Large Hadron Collider, the gigantic atom smasher outside Geneva, Switzerland, and it may be possible to detect dark matter. Dark matter is a form of matter that is invisible, it surrounds the galaxy, and we're clueless to figure out what dark matter is. Maybe, just maybe, dark matter can be predicted by string theory at the next vibration of a tiny string. That would nail it to the wall. And in the coming years, perhaps we will be able to find funding for a large atom smasher that may, in fact, be able to detect the presence of dark matter and prove or disprove the correctness of string theory, and then settle once and for all the question, what happened at the center of a black hole? And for that matter, what happened before the Big Bang? A theory of everything is also a theory of the Big Bang, and it should tell us whether or not there are other universes before the Big Bang. This is the multiverse idea. The multiverse idea is quite simple. It simply says that our universe is a bubble of some sort. It's expanding. That's the Big Bang theory. But our bubble coexists with other bubbles in an ocean, a bubble bath of other universes called the multiverse. Another question I get in the mail is, well, where did life come from anyway? Did it come from outer space? Did it come from the mountains, the air? Where did life originally come from? Well, if you take a look at the fossil evidence, we can get fossil evidence going back roughly 3.5 billion years. However, we have to realize that when the Earth was first formed, we enter the age of meteor impacts. So even if life got started, let's say, in the oceans, many times the oceans probably were boiled off by meteor impacts long, long time ago. But if the first DNA gets off the ground 3.5 billion years ago, there wasn't enough time for DNA to naturally gestate in the oceans. That's why some people, including the legendary figure Fred Hoyle, a leading cosmologist, that's why he believed in the panspermia theory. So at the present time, there are two theories as to where life began. The first theory is the one most commonly accepted. Life started in the oceans someplace or in a lake. It took place at the bottom of the oceans where there is energy coming from vents, volcano vents, hot water thermal vents, because this is an era before photosynthesis. Life requires energy. Energy from our life comes from plants, which get their energy from photosynthesis. But the very first cells did not have the mechanism to store energy via photosynthesis. However, volcano vents would give an immediate supply of energy to get hydrocarbons to create the first DNA molecule. However, the other theory says that maybe life came from outer space. And that theory has actually been getting some verification in the forms of meteors and comets from outside the solar system. Now, when you see a meteor, it's probably debris from the asteroid belt. The asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter. A lot of the asteroids there have orbits which eventually will intersect with the planet Earth. And so a lot of the meteors are caused by asteroids that fell out of the asteroid belt or the tails of comets. And we now know that meteors from other solar systems can actually reach our solar system. This was once theorized, but now we actually find evidence of this. How do we detect a meteor or comet from another solar system? Well, it's actually easier than you think. What you do is you get the trajectory of the known comets and meteors, run them through a computer, and then run the videotape backwards. We have Newton's laws of gravity, and therefore we can run the videotape backwards and determine where these things came from. And bingo, yes, we are finding that there are meteors that NASA tracks. When you run the videotape backwards on these meteors, by golly, they came from outside the solar system. And we now know that DNA can survive in outer space. Germs, bacteria, tiny microorganisms can actually survive on the surface of our space probes. Once again, contradicting common sense. So it means, therefore, that maybe, just maybe, life came from another planet or maybe even outside the solar system. For example, one day we're going to go to Mars and we're going to analyze the rocks on Mars and compare them with rocks that we think came from Mars that were blasted out of Mars by meteors and eventually drifted and landed on the Earth. That's right. Meteors from Mars have actually landed on the planet Earth. We know this because we look at the mineral content and it matches exactly the mineral content of Mars. We looked at trapped air bubbles inside these rocks, and bingo, once again, a perfect match with the chemical composition of the atmosphere of Mars. So we do know that Martian meteors have, in fact, landed on the planet Earth. And scientists, looking at the rocks using a microscope, have found wormy-like structures inside the rock. Now, this is still controversial. The people who found these worm-like structures said that maybe, just maybe, it's fossilized evidence of microbial life. Other people say, not so fast. Maybe it's just crystals, crystalline forms of minerals on Mars. We don't know for sure, but the point we're raising is, it is conceivable that life started on Mars first, then was blown into outer space by a meteor impact. These meteors drifted for millions of years in deep space and then finally landed on the Earth. So the next time you want to see a Martian, simply look in a mirror. Maybe you are the Martian. And then another question I get in the email is, well, a lot of people have been watching the Jurassic Park series. Is it possible to bring back the dinosaurs? Well, first of all, this is a serious question being asked at Harvard and other places where they believe we can bring back Ice Age mammals going back tens of thousands of years. For example, because of global warming, the tundra of Russia is gradually thawing out. I had a chance to see this firsthand when I gave a talk in Krasnoyarsk in Russia. And I talked to the people there, and they said, yes, they actually like global warming because it means that the climate is not so cold. And Ice Age animals are coming back, melting, that were frozen, but now are melting and are being retrieved by scientists. In fact, there's one mammoth, a near complete mammoth carcass frozen in the ice, which is gradually melting. So is it possible to extract DNA from them? Well, they have extracted pieces of DNA. Now they're using computers to put them together like a jigsaw puzzle. And yes, they do believe they can bring back the mammoth. The DNA from the mammoth would then be inserted into a female elephant who would then give birth to a baby mammoth. And then the question at Harvard that was raised is it ethical to bring back the Neanderthals? Because after all, we have now sequenced the DNA of Neanderthals. And in principle, it's possible to insert that DNA and give birth to a live baby Neanderthal. This was worked out at Harvard University. They haven't done it, but they say, yes, in principle, it's probably possible. But then that raises ethical questions. Some people have asked the question, what do you do with a young Neanderthal kid? Do you put him in a zoo or do you send him to Harvard? Big question. And then the question is, what about the dinosaurs? Well, these animals that we're talking about are Ice Age animals that go back 10, 20, maybe 50,000 years into the past. But dinosaurs, well, dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. However, there's a glimmer of hope. Several years ago, scientists cracked open the thigh bone of the hadrosaur, and what did they find inside? Much to their shock, they found soft tissue. This was not supposed to be possible. It was once believed that dinosaur bones are completely fossilized. They're mineralized, 100% minerals. All the DNA has been replaced by minerals. But no, by cracking open the thigh bone of the hadrosaur, they found soft tissue. Then they analyzed the chemical composition of the soft tissue. They did not find DNA, unfortunately, but they found protein fragments. Fragments of protein molecules, and they compared these molecules to molecules of proteins of animals today, and they found a resemblance to the DNA of frogs and turtles with the DNA from the dinosaurs. Since then, they've cracked open the thigh bones of other animals, and sure enough, they have found other evidences of soft tissue that has been hidden inside the skeletons of dinosaurs. Now, does that mean that one day we can bring back a dinosaur? That's still a long shot. If you saw the movie Jurassic Park, they bring back the dinosaurs because by chance they were able to find mosquitoes that sucked the blood of dinosaurs that were then encapsulated and then preserved in amber for over 65 million years ago. Well, so far we have not found evidence of that, but you can't rule it out. I mean, even the idea of bringing back the Neanderthal was once considered totally science fiction, but now, yeah, it's something that scientists have looked at, and we realize, yes, it could be possible. We should also point out that ancient diseases are now being analyzed, and we're now able to fill in the blanks of ancient history and modern history. When you take a look at the Irish potato famine, for example, the famine of the 1800s was so severe that the population collapsed in Ireland. Millions of people left, to the point where in America, you can find a city in America which has more Irish people than Irish people in Dublin. And so we have the enormous scars left over by ancient diseases. And scientists recently have sequenced the genes of the fungus that was responsible for the potato blight. There were many theories beforehand, but now they've actually been able to get back, analyze remnants of the potato famine, and use modern DNA sequencing to once and for all identify the culprit that caused the collapse of the Irish economy. I should also point out that there's some dangers involved. In 1918, we had the Spanish flu virus that actually killed more people than World War I. It is one of the greatest killers in the history of the human race. And the people who sequenced the genes of the Spanish flu virus did something that a lot of scientists, myself included, feel very uneasy about. They sequenced the genome and then they published it. That's right, one of the greatest killers in the history of the human race, its genome has been published so that in principle, a renegade scientist or renegade country would be able to resurrect this virus and unleash it, which would then be responsible for the deaths of hundreds of millions of people. It really means that we have to be very careful when we sequence the genes of these ancient diseases and then publish the genome, because in the future, perhaps high school kids will have a typewriter by which they can print out ATCG, ATCG, and create their own virus for a summer school project. It turns out that with CRISPR technology, we're able to edit DNA much easier than previously thought. And then the question is, what happens if teenagers get a hold of this technology? Well, that is something to think about, because that day could be coming. The day when even teenagers will be able to perform genetic engineering. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. In the second half of Exploration, we're going to continue a discussion of, well, Einstein, because it was his theory which gave us the black hole. But did you also know that he had a huge FBI file as well? So we'll talk about the other side of Albert Einstein, the activist side. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And stay tuned as we talk about the other side of the life of Albert Einstein. Black holes on one side, the FBI files on another. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the second half, we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about the political ideas and philosophies of Albert Einstein.
You know, we all know the stereotype of this befuddled, absent-minded scientist who misplaced his socks and never combed his hair. But did you actually realize that politically he was a radical? Politically, there's no other way to explain the fact that he was at the forefront of social change, and he put his life on the line. He opposed Adolf Hitler. And as a consequence, the Nazis actually put Einstein's face on the cover of one of their magazines with a caption, quote, "Not yet hanged," unquote. In other words, there was a price on the head of Albert Einstein, who spoke out against the Nazis. But he also spoke out against oppression, racial discrimination. He spoke on behalf of African Americans, he spoke for Jews, he spoke for people that he thought were the downtrodden. So once again, our special guest for the second half of the program is Fred Jerome, author of the book The Einstein Files, talking about the voluminous FBI files that J. Edgar Hoover kept on the genius Albert Einstein. Mr. Jerome, how did you first get interested in tracking down, of all things, Albert Einstein's FBI file?
Well, actually, it was about 8 years ago. I was doing a magazine piece on the media's coverage of Einstein, and I stumbled across a small reference in the New York Times, and I mean like page 17 of section D, right next to the weather map, which referred to the fact that the FBI had a file on him. And I was quite surprised and decided to go and get it. And when I read that file, and especially after I obtained the entire, or virtually the entire 1,800-page file on him, it was then that I realized that there was a tremendous amount of information there that we had been, that had been denied to us. It was almost like a shipment of history that had been hijacked. And I decided to write the book, which came out 2 years ago, The Einstein File, J. Edgar Hoover's Secret War Against the World's Most Famous Scientist.
Okay, well, let's talk about Einstein's political evolution, because his evolution, of course, spanned many decades.
Yes.
And he was there at very, very important pivotal events in world history and participated in some of them. So let's get back to his childhood. What was it going all the way back to his early days in Germany that led to his rather accelerated political evolution?
Well, it's interesting. He was born in 1879. And it was, he came of age, you might say, with both electricity and imperialism. Maybe that would account for some of his scientific pursuits, that is the electricity, and imperialism maybe with his, account for some of his political directions. The Kaiser, the German Kaiser said, I think around the same year he was born, maybe a year earlier, the great questions of the day will not be settled by resolutions and majority votes, but by blood and iron. And so you had the building up of this very militaristic Prussian society and a very militaristic Prussian army, which he, and also there was at the time a lot of anti-Semitism in Germany. In any case, he decided to avoid that militaristic Prussian army by leaving the country.
Now, a lot of teenagers don't all of a sudden decide to leave the country, renounce your citizenship. This is a rather dramatic statement to make. So was it that he was rebelling against Prussian militarism and conformity? Is that the reason why he decided to leave his country and give up German citizenship?
I think primarily. I mean, he was in school. He talked about his reaction to school was that elementary schools teachers were like sergeants, and high school teachers were like lieutenants. And, I mean, he'd been rebelling against it for some time. It wasn't a sudden, he didn't wake up one day and decided he was going to rebel.
Mm-hmm.
But his family, his parents actually were moving their business, which there was also a depression at the time, and small businesses were having a difficult time, and so on. But he was able to move to Switzerland, about as easily as I think a lot of people during Vietnam were able to move to Canada, and fortunately was able to go to school there. And when he went to the university in Zurich around the turn of the century, just before the turn of the century, it turns out that there were a lot of political refugees from other countries in Europe also hanging around Zurich. And that so he probably learned a good deal of his politics in Zurich at the Odeon Cafe, which was a popular gathering place for radical Russian refugees and others like Trotsky and Kalantai and so on and so forth. Not so, that he didn't go to class, but sometimes he didn't go to class.
Okay, so here we have a draft dodger, mm-hmm. Someone who renounces his own German nationality, mm-hmm. Tries to apply for Swiss citizenship, mm-hmm. and then is right in the thick of some of the greatest scientific turmoils of the time. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there were war clouds also looming around that time. So, of course, he was very well aware that as he became more prominent in the world of physics, that world war could break out. Mm-hmm. So given the fact that at Berlin University, where he finally aspired to when relativity theory finally bust open on the scene, mm-hmm. Many of the faculty members at the University of Berlin signed a manifesto agreeing with the Kaiser that
right.
this was the way to
right.
Support German civilization.
Most of them did, yes.
And so what did Einstein do, given the fact that there was all this war hysteria surrounding his university?
Well, it's interesting. I think, when he went back to Berlin from Switzerland in early 1914, he probably didn't expect World War II to break out. Maybe it was a little bit, I like to compare it to canceling a camping trip for a seat on the on a ship that's about to be sunk.
mm-hmm.
But in any case, he did, war did break out a few years after he got back to Berlin, a few months after he got back to Berlin, excuse me, in 1914. And he was one of really three academics in Germany who refused to sign this manifesto supporting the Kaiser's attack on the uncivilized hordes. Some of the words are much more explicit than that. And called for an end to the war and a united Europe.
So he was really sticking his neck out at that point, right? You figure he was a Jewish physicist in a country that was swept up by war fever. All the faculty were going with the Kaiser mm-hmm. in terms of enlisting for the military and working for the military. And here were these three intellectuals that opposed this gigantic tidal wave.
Yeah, I think he probably had a little bit of immunity from attack. Certainly one of the other intellectuals was almost arrested and was exiled from Germany. I think because he was Einstein and had already had his miracle year, and then in 1916 came up with the general theory of relativity, or was it 1917, to some extent they would allow him a little bit more leeway in what he said. But you never know how much, you know, and I think he was sticking his neck out to some extent.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about his political activities between wars.
Okay.
One thing I found out that I didn't know about was that the University of Berlin, after the chaos of World War I, was taken over by radical students.
Yeah.
And they had barricaded the campus and had actually taken the president of Berlin University hostage.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this crisis between the Weimar Republic and the German students.
Yeah.
And the German students wanted a radical professor who could negotiate a deal.
Yeah.
And, of course, everyone said, well, obviously it's got to be Einstein.
Right. Einstein, actually, there are a number of versions of what exactly happened during that particular period of uprising. But it seems clear that Einstein basically supported the Weimar Republic at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And how much he was able to influence the radical students is, I'm not sure, but it is on record that he told them that they ought to support the Weimar Republic and give it a chance and so on and so forth, which eventually did happen. I don't think he was able to totally detour the revolt. I don't think his words alone were able to detour the revolt.
Right. Well, Max Born, who is one of the founders of the quantum theory,
mm-hmm.
Actually accompanied Einstein on his visit to the students.
Right.
He went past the barricades
right.
where there were, you know, trash bins on fire and chaos mm-hmm. in the streets. And here we have two Nobel laureate physicists
right.
on their way to meet the radical students. And
yeah.
then after that, they went to the Reichstag, and they met with the Weimar Republic leaders, and they began to broker a deal.
Yeah,
it led to the release of the president of the poor university, who was captured by the students.
Yeah.
Now, also, one of the leaders of the Austrian Social Democratic Party, his son, assassinated one of the leaders of the German government. And the assassin was actually a physicist.
Right.
A physicist who was actually a friend of Einstein.
They had become friends in Zurich, actually.
Right.
They had been schoolmates.
Right. A professor Adler.
Right.
And normally, you would figure that a physicist who was a friend of an assassin would run for cover and basically try to protect their own skin by saying, I don't know this person.
Right.
Who is this person who just assassinated a German official?
Yes.
But here's Einstein coming to his defense.
Yeah, he actually testified on his behalf and offered to and really maybe saved his life.
That's right. So we have this stereotype of Einstein being this kind of absent-minded professor. But if anything, he was razor sharp. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew the limits of how far he could push, how far his fame could protect him.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that really is the key to my book and anybody who looks into Einstein's politics, is that we have been handed down this image in the last, certainly since Einstein's death, of a sort of bumbling, absent-minded, kindly old professor with his head too high in the clouds thinking of abstract equations to be concerned about what's going on in the real world, whereas the fact of the matter is he was quite concerned, and he continued to be concerned, and he was concerned when he was in this country, and he opposed McCarthyism. He was very outspoken, and he particularly opposed racism in this country. And it's not at all the image that we have been handed down over the last 50 years.
When I was growing up, some people would say, when they mentioned his politics at all, they would say that he was naive, that he didn't really understand the larger real forces at work.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything, to me, it's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't see himself as a pragmatic compromise maker that cuts deals in a parliament. That was not his role.
No.
His role was to be more like a Gandhi, to set the spiritual and moral tenor of the affair. That was his role. And I think he was very clearly cognizant of the role that he would play in political crises.
Yeah. In fact, we're skipping past a few things here, but just to mention that he was asked to endorse and support hundreds and hundreds of organizations. And he actually did endorse and support, I counted, some 70 of those. But each one was carefully thought through, and many were rejected. And it was those which he supported, which he felt were going to be the most effective. He lent his prestige, really, to the cause of his moral and political indignation.
Right.
Okay. Has been said.
Right. Now let's move on a little bit. War clouds start to brew once again as World War II approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1933, Einstein leaves the country for good. And the newspapers say that the Pope of Physics has left. The new Vatican is Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
However, the question is, what was Einstein's attitude toward the Nazis? Some pacifists said that we should allow Hitler to take power and show what an idiot he is, allow him to do his dirty work. Well, Einstein said no.
Yeah, almost as soon as the Nazis came to power, and maybe even before then a little bit, his position, his pacifism, which he had, after World War I, he had become involved in pacifist organizations, such as the War Resisters League and others around the world, his pacifism began to be, he began to qualify his pacifism because of the Nazis. And he felt that the Nazis presented such a horrendous threat to mankind that they probably could only be defeated through a military struggle. And we know now that he wrote the letter to Roosevelt in 1939, urging Roosevelt to consider launching an atomic bomb project, because he was convinced at that time that the Nazis had launched an atomic bomb project. And he didn't want Hitler and the Nazis to have a sort of an atomic monopoly and be able to blackmail the rest of the world with the atomic bomb.
And as history has shown, Einstein's instincts, once again, were much much more clear than the so-called political realists. As we now know, Germany did have a very active atomic bomb project set up before the United States. We know that the world's greatest quantum physicist, Werner Heisenberg, was the head of the German Nazi program. And we now know, just within the last few years, that Werner Heisenberg did not sabotage the German project, but he actively worked on a German atomic bomb.
Right.
So we have the world's greatest quantum physicist working for the Nazis to build a super bomb for Germany.
Absolutely. And I think Einstein, even after the war, because after the Germans, after it became clear the Germans, despite Heisenberg, were not going to succeed in making an atomic bomb, Einstein's position changed, and he did not want the U.S. to use the atomic bomb.
Now, by the way, during the war, a lot of people, of course, asked the simple question, why doesn't Einstein work on top-secret military projects? But apparently the military itself at that point axed the idea that Einstein would work on the atomic bomb.
One of the points I make in my book, The Einstein File, is that J. Edgar Hoover was instrumental in helping the military, military intelligence, actually deny security clearance to Einstein in 1940, the same year he became a citizen. And it was based on that denial that Einstein was unable to work on the Manhattan Project.
But isn't it also true that J. Edgar Hoover was intimidated by Einstein? I mean, everyone around Einstein was grilled by the FBI except Einstein himself. He was never grilled by the FBI. And so some people speculate that maybe J. Edgar Hoover was actually intimidated by Einstein.
Well, it's possible. I like to think of it as not just intimidated by Einstein, but by the fact that Einstein had such a worldwide following that I think Hoover knew. And in fact, in the file, he makes several references to the fact that ordering his men not to interrogate Einstein, not to interrogate anyone who might tell Einstein that he was being asked about, because Einstein had this habit of calling press conferences and telling the world about these things. And so I think that what he was afraid of in the case of Einstein was that Einstein would tell everybody that the FBI was investigating him, and Hoover would look like the ass that he was, and, you know, a laughingstock of the world. So I don't think it was just Einstein alone that intimidated Hoover, but Einstein and his worldwide following, which was so tremendous.
Okay, now let's take a look at the post-war era. Einstein was asked after Hiroshima, would he have worked on the atomic bomb, and knowing what he did about what happened to Hiroshima, and he said that if he had known that his work would lead to the bombing of Hiroshima, he would have become a fisherman rather than a theoretical physicist.
Yes.
So now what happens after the bombing of Hiroshima?
Well, I think even I just mentioned that even before the bombing of Hiroshima, Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt again at the behest of Leo Szilard, urging Roosevelt not to bomb Japan. And it was found on Roosevelt's desk the morning after Roosevelt died. And so that there was this strong feeling among many scientists, Einstein included, against the bombing of Hiroshima. After that bombing, many of the scientists who worked on the bomb, including Szilard and Oppenheimer, well, many of them, Beta and so on, formed a committee, or many committees, actually. The committee that Einstein became the chairman of was the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists. And they issued protest after protest against the growing nuclear arms race, and they also spread information about the nature of nuclear weapons among the public, to the public, which has got the FBI terribly upset, because the FBI was convinced they were going to release information about the atomic bomb, and the Russians were going to read it, and then the Russians would have the atomic bomb.
Now, I understand that in different versions, incarnations of these groups still exist. The Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists no longer exists, but we have the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
Yes.
And that network of nuclear physicists set up by Einstein still exists as the Federation of American Scientists,
that's
many
correct.
Of them populated by nuclear physicists who worked on the atomic bomb during the Manhattan Project years.
That's correct. And Einstein articles were, I think, in the very first issue of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. He had a piece and several others. And that still exists, and the spirit, I think, still exists, the spirit of reaching out to the public on these questions has not been completely crushed.
Okay, now let's talk about the McCarthy years.
Yes.
And once again, when the waters get troubled, there's a tendency for professors to run like hell and hide under the covers.
Mm-hmm.
And here's Einstein going right up against McCarthyism.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that.
I think it may be that perhaps his greatest legacy to the future, or as great as any, I don't want to take away from any of his science, the legacy of his science, but I'm not the first one to say this. An Einstein expert in Boston, John Stachel, who's the head of the Center for Einstein Studies at Boston University, has said this, that one of his greatest legacies certainly is his example of the courage that he demonstrated in standing up to the McCarthy committees and the other congressional investigating committees and urging people to refuse to answer questions. This is in 1953, even if it meant going to jail, and that it was the only way to defeat these committees. And if enough people did it, the committees would be finished and McCarthyism would be finished. And it was a call for civil disobedience at a time when he was the first one to do that, really, and was attacked for doing that, even by the New York Times and the Washington Post. And yet he did it, and it did have an impact on many people. Within a year, McCarthy was on the rocks, and I think he was censured the next year, 1954. In any case, Einstein's call, urging of witnesses to refuse to answer questions from these committees, it made the front page of the New York Times twice in 1 year, in 1953. In June and in December. And if it made the front page of the New York Times, you can be sure it made the front page of newspapers around the world then as now. And that had a tremendous impact, I think, on the sort of turning around of the McCarthy period, although that turning around took a while to complete.
Right. Now let's talk about racism. Einstein, of course, being Jewish, had to bear the brunt of anti-Semitism, especially in Germany.
Yes.
But also he was very involved with the African-American movement here in this country, which is not widely known.
Absolutely.
Could you elaborate?
Of all the little-known aspects of Einstein's political dimension, his anti-lynching and anti-racism activity is the least known. And in 1946... after World War II, there was a wave of lynchings that swept across America, especially the southern states. Some 56 black men and women, mostly GIs, were lynched in this country, compared to something like 3 in the last year before the war. And Einstein spoke out against that, as he had on many other issues. And in September of 1946, he was co-chairman with Paul Robeson of a group called the American Crusade to End Lynching, which led a march on Washington in September to demand that the federal government pass anti-lynching legislation. Einstein wrote a letter to Truman. He was unable to actually attend the march because of his poor health. He also spoke at Lincoln University, a black college, the oldest black college in this hemisphere. He spoke there in 1946. In May, he received an honorary degree, and he generally did not do this during the last years of his life. He didn't go to colleges. Okay, he had many invitations. But he wanted to send a message, and the message that he sent in the speech was that racism was the worst. Well, he said in this speech, he said segregation was a white man's disease, and I'm not going to remain silent about it. And later on, he said racism was America's worst disease. And this, what's interesting is that this speech at Lincoln University in 1946, the most famous scientist in the world at the oldest black institution of learning in the hemisphere, not a word has been published in a single biography of Einstein anywhere, and that counts hundreds of books. And it's an example of the fact that this vital aspect of Einstein's outlook has been kept from us. And I think in this day and age especially, we all suffer as a result of not knowing it.
Okay, now let's talk about the Jewish question, mm-hmm. because obviously he bore the brunt of a lot of anti-Jewish slurs and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But just before he died, being this world figure that he was actually offered the presidency of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what was his position on Zionism and his relationship to Israel?
Actually, that offering him of the presidency by Israel was a very clever public relations move. It got a lot of attention. In fact, Einstein, when they offered it to him, I have a quote here from Ben Gurion, which said that, what are we ever going to do if he accepts the presidency? Because I've had to offer it to him because it's impossible not to, but if he accepts, he says, we are in for trouble. And I think the fact of the matter is that Einstein was highly critical of the policy of the Israeli government and the Zionist leadership, of their policy, especially their policy towards Arabs. And at one point he wrote to Weizmann, the head of Zionism, he said, if we do not succeed in finding the path of honest cooperation and coming to terms with the Arabs, we will not have learned anything from our 2,000-year-old ordeal and will deserve the fate which will beset us. And another time he said, the most important aspect of Israel's policy must be our ever-present manifest desire to institute complete equality for the Arab citizens living in our midst. And the attitude we adopt towards the Arab minority will provide the real test of our moral standards as a people. And there's more. I mean, it's something that's not widely known, and I know that there are Jews, some in this country, who don't like to hear this. But the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of statements like this. Einstein actually opposed the formation of the Jewish state until after it was formed, and then he did support it.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. And if you want to find out more about Einstein's theories, his work, and his life, get a copy of my earlier book, Einstein's Cosmos. And I was personally staggered, absolutely staggered, doing the research for this biography of Albert Einstein, realizing that at key junctions in world history, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, there was Albert Einstein putting his life and his reputation on the line. On one hand, changing humanity by introducing relativity and the wonders of science into society, and on the other hand, searching for a world where human dignity and human equality would be paramount. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, inviting you to join us every week for a discussion of science and its impact on society. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.